Now, from foreign to domestic issues, the economy was a big topic in the recent chats between Pastor Rick Warren and Senators McCain and Obama. One of the most challenging questions he put to the candidates, define rich.
If you're just talking about income, how about $5 million?
I would argue that if you're making more than $250,000, then you're in the top 3-4% of this country. You're doing well.
Senators McCain and Obama answered with two very different figures. In today's economy, figuring out who is rich and who's middle class is a bit tricky. Here to help us sort through it is Jared Bernstein. He's a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Thank you for joining us. And if we could start off talking numbers, you know, we use income levels to make all sorts of assessments, but is there any way to numerically determine whether or not someone's rich?
No, there isn't. There's just too much variation around the country, geographical variation. Someone who has an income of $150,000 and lives in a poor rural neighborhood in the South is absolutely rich. Yet that income in the city of Manhattan, with a kid or two going to a top university paying sticker price, I'm sure you're feeling a pinch. What I can tell you, the number that John McCain cited, $5 million, there's almost nobody up there.
And what about middle class? That one seems even mushier. Is there any way to kind of relatively gauge whether or not you can be considered middle class?
My definition of middle class would be between $35,000 and somewhere like $100,000, which is a range that's probably too broad to be meaningful to anyone. To me, the numbers really don't help you that much here. I think it has a lot to do with the kind of access to opportunity or the choices that you have in life that really determines whether you're rich or middle class.
And whether or not you consider yourself rich or middle class, what effects or implications does that have on a person in terms of how they spend, how they save, what job choices they make?
I think there are people lower down the income scale, say lower middle class or poor, who have to ask themselves, can I afford to go out to eat tonight? Can I afford this long-distance call or another month of cell phone bills? Can I afford an internet connection? Yet those questions don't arise very often for people in the middle class, and they don't arise at all for rich people. So it has a lot to do with choices.
We heard earlier how each of the presidential candidates assess wealth. How might their understanding affect the way that each of them would run this country?
What you heard Obama say is if your income is above $250,000, you're doing pretty well. His tax plan actually does raise taxes on people whose income is above $250,000. McCain has a very different view. Now, you heard him say $5 million. I think he just threw off that line. I wouldn't really attack him too much on that. McCain is kind of following the Bush model of tax policy, where you cut taxes quite deeply at the top of the scale, not much in the middle or the bottom. Obama's closer to the Clinton model, where you give some tax relief to folks in the middle at the bottom and you raise taxes at the high end.
Jared Bernstein of the Economic Policy Institute, thanks.
My pleasure.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen.
All right, some badly needed good news on the economy and food. It looks as though the U.S. corn crop is going to be much bigger than the food industry had thought. That, plus the dip in oil prices and other factors, has brought world food prices down a little bit since record highs of a few months ago.
But aside from that small blessing, the cost of food is way higher than it's ever been. People around the globe have to spend at least 60% more to buy grains and cooking oil than they did just a couple of years ago. Some prices are double or triple.
And there have been widespread riots in different places around the world earlier this year.
Egyptian police fire tear gas to try to disperse crowds after 2 days of demonstrations. The anger here at low.
World leaders also warned at their summit last month that high food prices still threaten, quote, global food security. Some analysts say prices are going to drop before too long. Others say the food crisis is already so serious that for many people, life will never go back to normal or whatever normal was. NPR's Daniel Zwerdling joins us. Danny, hello again. Who is most affected by this?
Let's start with the people who are living near the edge. You know, the United Nations says that roughly 800 million people around the world chronically don't get enough food.
Nearly 1 billion people, but you don't actually mean that they are starving.
No, most of them are not starving, but they never eat enough to be really healthy. And the thing is that food prices this year are pushing some of those people over the brink. And listen to this conversation I had with a top relief official in Ethiopia. His name is Mark Nosbach. Ethiopia, of course, has seen its share of horrible food problems over the decade. You're saying you have never seen this combination of problems.
No. And I think that is what is taking us perhaps all by surprise. This makes it a very difficult situation that we haven't witnessed before.
Mark Nosbach is the assistant director in Ethiopia for Save the Children. That's the international aid group. A lot of people assume that things have always been desperate in Ethiopia, and they always will be. But the fact is, Ethiopia and some other poor countries have made a lot of economic progress in recent years. And the tragedy is, this progress is unraveling because of food prices. In Ethiopia, for instance, relief workers tell me that a sack of dried corn, and that's one of the main foods, cost 10 times as much in the local markets as it did a year ago. So Nosbach says they're seeing more and more children who have the kind of malnutrition that causes permanent physical and mental side effects.
They will not be able to be as good at school as they would have if they would have proper nutritional intake. So that's one aspect that in the long run will impact them. And I think a lot of the efforts we normally do in the development work of providing schools and education are being undermined.
So you're saying if these international problems and the problems in Ethiopia persist even for months more, and we're not even talking about years, that there could be tens of thousands of children who grow up permanently impaired in Ethiopia alone?
Yes.
Specialists at development groups say they're seeing these danger signs in other countries too. And there's an even more important reason why some analysts are concerned. They say even if prices do drop in the short term, say in the next few months or years, they say the world is changing in profound ways that could disrupt the food supply for generations. For instance,
one of the things that worries a lot of people is depletion of groundwater.
Alex Evans used to be a top advisor in Britain's International Development Agency. Now he's studying food trends for a British think tank and for New York University. Evans says back in the 1960s and 70s, the Green Revolution created a kind of miracle. Farmers in countries like India started growing three times as much rice on every field. And as you probably know, they did it by using hybrid seeds and fertilizers and pesticides. And they pumped huge amounts of groundwater to irrigate their crops.
But a lot of time, that was using wells dug into aquifers. It's like mining water that doesn't get replenished. And one of the big worries is that kind of debt, if you like, is about to start coming due. That, you know, already, for instance, in parts of India, you see farmers having to drill deeper and deeper to keep getting water. And it's not something they can continue doing indefinitely.
Meanwhile, just about everybody predicts that the world will keep demanding more oil, so people should get used to high energy prices. The population will keep rising, so countries will compete even more for food. And don't forget, the world's climate is changing. In fact, the weather in some areas is already getting unpredictable.
It's always hard to look at a particular weather impact and say definitively, this is because of climate change. But it's absolutely the case that looking around the world, you can see many of the impacts that are consistent with the sort of effect you'd expect to see more of with climate change already causing problems for farmers.
So analysts like Evans say there's a good chance that food prices will keep going higher over the next few decades, even if there are temporary dips. But they say there is a way out. The world's leaders could launch sweeping programs to revamp the food system. They could develop new kinds of energy. They could invest massive amounts of money to help poor farmers. And they could reform world trade to make it more fair.
I do think that it's entirely possible to feed a population that will rise to about 10 billion people by mid-century, but above all with collective action.
What signs are you seeing that the world's leaders have the bold vision you say the world needs to head off a bigger food crisis? You just laughed while I asked that question.
I do not think that world leaders have the bold vision that ultimately will be needed. But in fairness, I don't think other people do either. I mean, I think there are parts of the agenda that, you know, we haven't started really figuring out yet.
And that was Alex Evans. He's a food researcher based in the UK. And you, Alexes, both of you in Los Angeles, as you know, President Bush and other world leaders talked about the food crisis at their annual summit meeting just last month.
This is the G8 meeting in Japan. What did they actually do about the food crisis there?
They mainly put out a statement. It says, and I'm quoting here, quote, "We are determined to take all possible measures in a coordinated manner to solve the food crisis." And here's what's so striking about that rhetoric. That is pretty much the same thing that U.S. presidents and other leaders have been saying for 50 years.
We have the ability, as members of the human race, we have the means, we have the capacity to eliminate hunger from the face of the earth in our lifetime. We need only the will.
That is President John F. Kennedy. I know that voice.
You got it. And Kennedy was speaking at the World Food Congress in 1963. And by the way, the latest round of World Trade talks collapsed a few weeks ago, partly because leaders cannot agree on how to reform the way they trade food.
NPR's Daniel Zwerdling. Danny, thank you.
Thank you.
Steve?
Yes?
Did you really want to come back from your vacation in Cape Cod? seems like an awfully long time ago.
Well, you know, it was tempting to stay, especially since I could have avoided the traffic getting out of there, but I did have to go eventually.
Right. Well, I didn't even want to leave Crestone, Colorado when I was vacationing there, and hear now a story about Americans who aren't leaving vacation spots. They're moving to those places, like Flagstaff, Arizona. That's a scenic town near the Grand Canyon. And it's something Arizona Public Radio's Daniel Crocker knows about because he's there.
For centuries, the San Francisco peaks just north of Flagstaff have been a beacon, soaring nearly 13,000 feet above the desert. First Native Americans, then early pioneers, were drawn to the cool, pine-blanketed mountains. And now the Flagstaff High Country is luring a new wave of settlers. For the past 8 years, this college town has been Mary Stone's home away from home. She makes the two-hour drive from the Phoenix Valley up to her second home here every chance she gets. She strides into her spacious living room, where huge windows overlook the Coconino National Forest.
As soon as I came to Flagstaff, I felt at home in a way I hadn't felt probably any place else I've ever lived. It's the people, it's the arts, it's the free exchange of ideas, the natural surroundings.
Stone and her husband are planning to retire in Flagstaff. In fact, Mary Stone is already spending much of her time here. She was named Volunteer of the Year in 2007.
Right now, my driver's license has my Flagstaff address, and I'm registered to vote in Flagstaff. I care more about Flagstaff. It sounds terrible, because I've had a home in the valley for 16 years now.
Newcomers like Mary Stone have been flocking to Flagstaff and other picturesque resort and college towns since the 1970s. But in the past two decades, their numbers have exploded. Kenneth Johnson is senior demographer at the University of New Hampshire's Carsey Institute. He says the Stones' experience in Flagstaff is typical of what he calls amenity migrants.
Like many of us, they would say, boy, when I can, I'd really like to live in one of these beautiful scenic areas. And as they get close to retirement, they can fulfill those wishes. And sometimes for people who are consultants or have more flexible sorts of work schedules, they may just begin to spend more and more time in their second homes.
Johnson has identified 300 recreation or amenity regions across the country, from western ski towns to New England to the lake country of the upper Midwest. While other small towns are dying, these communities are booming. They're growing 2 to 3 times faster than other rural areas, even faster than many metro areas. And as the baby boomers retire, Johnson says the migration will accelerate.
You get the wave of the baby boom, which is bigger than the wave before it. And on top of that, the baby boomers are more likely to purchase these kinds of second homes or amenity homes or move to these areas. And so you get essentially a demographic perfect storm.
The newcomers can bring a lot of expertise, even new businesses, to their adopted hometowns, what Johnson calls human capital. But not everyone welcomes the changes.
This is the old family mercantile, which opened in 1889. So you see the old sign up on the side of the building that says Ranchers, Merchants, and Indian Traders.
Jim Babbitt grew up in Flagstaff with his brother Bruce, who became Arizona's governor and U.S. Secretary of the Interior. The family's century-old sandstone building, two blocks away from Flagstaff's historic train station, is now a camping gear store.
People come to the nice little mountain town. So pretty soon, guess what? They want to live here or at least have a part-time home here. And what is about the first thing they want to do when they get here? Start changing it into the place where they came from. Another park or, you know, some walking trails near their home or, God forbid, a Starbucks.
A popular bumper sticker around town reads, "Don't Phoenix Flagstaff." More than one out of every four homes sold in Flagstaff now is bought by a second homeowner. Longtime Flagstaff resident Derek Turner says they're partly to blame for Flagstaff's high cost of living.
They certainly pushed the housing market up, and the people who live here and want to stay here full-time can't afford the houses. So either they struggle or they're forced to move somewhere else.
In fact, the median home price has more than doubled in the past 8 years. Even the national housing crash has barely affected prices in Flagstaff. And the gap between that median home price and the average household income is twice as large as the national average. Some newcomers are shocked at how hard it is to find a decent paying job.
One-income families here, they might as well put up a sign that says, stay away, because unless you come with wealth, it's hard to make it here.
Sue Mattson moved here 4 years ago from the Boston area. She thought she could make a new, simpler life for herself in Flagstaff and make a positive contribution to the community. Instead, she scraped by on a series of low-paying jobs. So Mattson found herself in a used bookstore using the free Wi-Fi to search for jobs online.
And we go to Sue's favorites, and I'm really not seeing anything at this point.
Mattson says she wasn't surprised it was tough to find work.
I was surprised that even once you found it, you weren't getting paid enough to stay in Flagstaff. People would give their eye teeth to stay in Flagstaff, and they are giving their eye teeth to stay in Flagstaff.
In the end, Mattson left Flagstaff. But for others, Flagstaff's quality of life is worth the sacrifices, sometimes extreme sacrifices. 9 years ago, Colleen Barnett and her husband drove up from Southern California for vacation.
One of the things that struck us was in Los Angeles, in the big metropolitan areas, you're kind of anonymous. And here, we're walking down the street and people are saying hi to us and nodding and making eye contact and how are you? And, you know, it was a little uncomfortable at first because we're not used to this.
The Barnetts bought a piece of property for retirement. Then Colleen found a job as a loan officer at a Flagstaff bank with a 30% pay cut. But her husband wasn't ready to leave his job as a chief financial officer with a large corporation.
So here we are 7.5 years later, and my husband is still working in California and now commutes back and forth, flies out on Monday evening and comes home Friday morning. Well, meanwhile, I'm up here living in paradise.
So is her son, who followed his parents to Flagstaff. He's now an officer with the city's police department, exactly the kind of newcomer with human capital that demographer Kenneth Johnson talked about. But like many other middle-class residents, he can't afford to buy a home. Flagstaff business owner Jim Babbitt doesn't expect the housing situation to improve as the city continues to grow.
The Chamber of Commerce and the Boosters have sought growth for as long as I can remember, and boy, they've got it now. And, you know, along with that growth comes rising prices, gentrification, and I've always thought, be careful what you ask for.
And that's a problem that Flagstaff and towns like it don't have much time left to solve. How to accommodate the growth they know is coming without losing the small-town character that attracted everyone in the first place. For NPR News, I'm Daniel Crocker in Flagstaff.
And that report was produced by Arizona Public Radio with NPR's Local News Initiative. Tomorrow, we'll explore how growth, a problem for some towns, is an opportunity for others.
Stock markets around the world are rattled today by more news that housing finance giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are in big trouble. A recent report from Barron's says Fannie and Freddie's collapse is almost inevitable.
To get a sense of how that might affect the already troubled U.S. economy, we're joined now by Gus Fauché. He's the director of macroeconomics for Moody'sEconomy.com. Thank you for joining us, Gus. And can you answer, first of all, are Fannie and Freddie truly on the verge of failure?
Well, I'm not sure that they're on the verge of failure, but they are facing severe severe problems. I mean, certainly it's a case that they've taken on some mortgages that have gone bad, and those are causing problems for Fannie and Freddie. And I think, you know, their situation is tenuous. It could be that the federal government is going to need to step in and take them over, but it's still unclear at this point what exactly is going to happen.
What are some of the potential outcomes, and what would they mean to the average mortgage holder?
Well, for the average mortgage holder, they're not going to make much of a difference. Presumably, if the Feds step in and take over Fannie and Freddie, that would simply mean that instead of their payments going to these what we call government-sponsored enterprises, they'd go directly to the Treasury Department. But it wouldn't, if you're a mortgage holder and Fannie or Freddie hold your mortgage, you wouldn't see much change at all. I mean, obviously, the big problems would be for shareholders who, in the event of a federal takeover, would likely be wiped out.
And we should mention that the government doesn't have to bail them out if they get into trouble, correct?
I think at this point the federal government would need to step in. Fannie and Freddie, they either own or insure about one half of the mortgages in the U.S. There are big problems with credit flowing to mortgage markets right now, and Fannie and Freddie are really pretty much the only game in town there. So I think the Feds are concerned that if something happens, if Fannie and Freddie fail, then we'd see a much more severe downturn in the housing market. And one advantage, perhaps, of the federal government taking over Fannie and Freddie is that it could bring down mortgage rates a bit. If you look at the spread between the interest rates that Fannie and Freddie are paying versus risk-free treasuries, that spread has widened a bit, which indicates that people are perhaps a bit reluctant to lend to Fannie and Freddie, despite the rescue package at the federal government put together last month. So if the Feds take it over and the Treasury Department is essentially running them, then that would allow Fannie and Freddie to borrow at lower rates, and that could bring down mortgage rates for home borrowers.
So as dark as the clouds are now, there might be silver lining for future home buyers?
I think that's the case. There could be some advantages. And then over the longer run, we need to think about what our mortgage policy should be, how involved the federal government should be in the market, but I think that's a decision for the next president.
Gus, I know this is asking a very big question, but when do you possibly see the banks being able to pull out of this crisis?
Well, it's going to take some time. I mean, there are a lot of excesses that developed over the past few years. Too many homes were built. There are people who, in retrospect, who got mortgages who probably shouldn't have. And so it's taking some time for all this to fall out. Inventories are going to need to decline further, so we have builders cutting back. You know, they're building fewer homes, and we saw that again today. At the same point, we see prices falling, which will make housing more affordable for some folks. So, you know, we probably don't think conditions are going to stabilize until sometime in the first half of next year.
I have to say, for someone who's saying that conditions aren't going to stabilize until maybe sometime next year, you sound relatively calm. I think for the average Joe, you keep hearing these stories, and it's hard not to panic. Why shouldn't we be panicking?
Well, I think for most homeowners, as long as you didn't buy in the past few years, you're probably in okay shape. It could be that the value of your house has gone down, but it's probably still worth more than you paid for it. You probably are able to afford your mortgage payments. So those folks are doing okay. I mean, obviously, it's not good if the value of your house declines, but at the same point, they're not facing severe financial distress. I think there are people who have purchased their home more recently or perhaps refinanced. Maybe they faced a higher interest rate because they had an adjustable rate mortgage. Maybe they qualified for a loan that, in retrospect, they probably shouldn't have gotten. So there are some people who are facing some severe problems. But I think for the majority of homeowners, they're not in immediate danger.
That's Gus Vaucher. He's the director of macroeconomics for MoodysEconomy.com. We just heard about the potential silver lining for future home buyers. If you are a first-time buyer, things may be looking even brighter thanks to a new tax credit. Later on in the program, our personal finance contributor, Michelle Singletary, fills us in on how it works. That's coming up when NPR's Day to Day continues.